The first bill we're here today, we're going to jump down one to House Bill 2225, and you have John Fessner as a witness.
Good morning, Chair Barker and members of the committee. My name is Jonathan Fessner. I'm an Assistant Attorney General with the Oregon Department of Justice. Speaking to House Bill 2225, the intent of this bill is to clarify how appellate courts review convictions in cases that involve violations as opposed to cases that involve criminal offenses. A violation is simply an offense that carries only a fine and not a jail penalty. Currently, the way that these cases are briefed, and I'm the attorney who briefs them and assigns them out for briefing for the state, the way they're briefed is they are briefed under what we call a de novo standard of review, which means it's as though you're trying the whole case all over again to the judges of the appellate court. Now, we don't present new evidence, but we do have the record of the case, which is the trial that occurred in the trial court. And the de novo review, de novo is just a fancy Latin word for a new look at, requires that the parties convince the judges of the appellate court that the defendant is guilty. This requires a fairly extensive amount of briefing. It's as though you're starting afresh, as though the trial itself never happened. There is a different standard of review that House Bill 2225 would enact as the appropriate standard for these violation cases, and that is simply whether there was enough evidence produced at the trial that a rational trier of fact, that would be the judge who heard the case, could find the defendant guilty. And so you will have the Court of Appeals, for example, being able to say, we might or might not be convinced ourselves. If we were sitting as a judge, we might or might not find the person guilty. But the trial judge found this person guilty, and there was enough evidence to support that conviction. Let me just give you a very brief example. You have a police officer who gets on the stand. He testifies, I saw the defendant pull up to the stop sign and not stop at the stop sign, blew the stop sign. The defendant gets on the stand and says, I stopped at the stop sign, and the officer couldn't have seen me from where he was sitting. And there are diagrams, and there are maps, and there are photographs, and there are eyewitnesses, and there is a big whole trial. Excuse me. Under de novo review, you'd have to go through all of that evidence again, explain, if you're the state, you'd have to explain why it is that the defendant's testimony is not credible, not as believable as the police officer's, why the officer's testimony is believable. And it takes a long time to do that. It's a work issue, really, for not only us in the Department of Justice, but also for the court, because the judges are conscientious on the Court of Appeals, and they will read the record, and they will make their own decision, and they'll read these extensive briefs and have oral argument on the case. Under the proposed standard of review in this bill, all we would have to do is file probably a one-page brief that says, look, the officer testified that he saw the defendant blow the stop sign. If the trier of fact believed the officer, which the trier of fact is entitled to do, there was sufficient evidence to support the conviction. And the Court of Appeals will say, that's right, we don't need to get into all the details of it. We can affirm that conviction knowing that there was sufficient evidence. I might point out, too, there are two things. One is, this is the standard of review that is used now in the Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court in criminal cases where there's a potential jail or prison term involved. So this is not a big change, but it is significant to the parties who brief these cases and to the courts that decide them. The second thing I would like to emphasize is this bill is very limited in its scope. It does not change anything that happens at the trial level. Currently, in violation cases, the state is required to prove the case by a preponderance of the evidence, not beyond a reasonable doubt. That does not change under the bill. Currently, in violation cases, the defendant does not have a right to an appointed attorney at public expense. That does not change under the bill. And currently, the defendant in a violation case does not have a right to a jury trial, and that does not change. We're talking here primarily about the minor traffic violations and possession of less than an ounce and a few other offenses that are violations, as well as cases that started out as misdemeanors and were reduced to violations by the prosecutor in the trial court. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions members of the committee might have.
Questions?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Fester, my only question is, how did we get to a situation where these violations were having a de novo review at the appeals, Court of Appeals?
We got there simply because there is no statute that tells the court what standard to use. Now, in a case called State versus Ryder in 1998, the Oregon Court of Appeals looked at this question, and we used to have a statute that provided for de novo review. And the parties in Ryder, both the state and the defendant, assumed that that statute governed, and that's the standard, as I said, that we've been using in the court, partly because we used to have that statute that said that's the standard of review. The court in Ryder noted in its opinion that that statute had been repealed, and in fact was not even in effect at the time of the trial in Ryder or the appeal. And the court simply said, we express no opinion on what the effect of that repeal is and what the proper standard of review should be. The parties have treated it as de novo review, and that's how they resolved it. So I think it's fair to say that this is an issue that the appellate courts have not definitively answered.
Any further questions?
Thank you. I take a motion to move.
Well, a work session.
Oh, I'm sorry. Thank you. We'll move from public hearing into work session.
Mr. Chair.
Representative McPherson.
I move that we move House Bill 2225 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Representative Olson?
Aye.
Representative Foster?
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye. And I'll ask Representative McPherson to carry the bill. Get close. Next bill is House Bill 2224. Mr. Fessner again. Ms. Maud, would you give us a quick rundown, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2224 would require an appellate court, after reversing some but not all of the counts on appeal, to remand the case to the trial court for resentencing on remaining counts. A case was provided to me by the Attorney General's Office, State versus Fry, as an example of a time when this maybe would have been where the Attorney General's Office believes it would have been appropriate to send all of the counts back to the trial court. It is essentially an effort to prevent a defendant from getting a windfall based on the way a case was sentenced at the trial court level if certain counts are done concurrently versus consecutively.
Thank you. Mr. Foster.
Chair Barker and members of the committee, again, my name is Jonathan Fussner, Assistant Attorney General at the Oregon Department of Justice. This bill may take a little bit of explaining because it's a pretty arcane little part of appellate practice, but it does matter especially in criminal cases in which the sentencing court at the trial level has determined what the overall prison or jail sentence ought to be in a particular case. You have multiple convictions arising out of the same case, let us say. And I'm going to give you an example that I hope makes it concrete. Let's say the defendant's convicted of three charges. On the first one, the court gives him a prison sentence of 60 months. And on the second two, prison sentence of 30 months on each one. And the court runs all these sentences concurrently, so they're all served at the same time. So our defendant here is going to serve his first 30 months on all three counts, then he'll be done with two of the counts, and he'll continue on serving the remainder of the 60 months only on the one count that got a 60-month sentence. But before that happens, he appeals the case, and the Court of Appeals decides the conviction on the 60-month sentence is invalid for some reason. And it's important to remember here, we're talking only about invalid completely, such that it can't be fixed by retrying the case. A good example of that is if the court finds that the state did not present sufficient evidence to support the conviction and reverses that conviction, there's no retrial in a situation like that. It is gone forever and it can't be revived. Similarly, if the court were to find that the statute under which that conviction occurred is constitutionally invalid, then that's never going to be retried. It's simply going to disappear. So now, our defendant, who the court thought should serve 60 months out of all three of these convictions, has that 60-month conviction set aside, and now he's only going to serve 30 months. This violates the intention of the sentencing court. What House Bill 2224 would do is require the Court of Appeals, in all such cases, to send the remaining valid counts back to the trial court for resentencing, at which time the sentencing judge, for example, might be able to take those two 30-month concurrent sentences, change them to consecutive sentences, and reestablish that total 60-month sentence. Now, that won't always be possible for the trial court to do that, but at least we think that the trial court should have the opportunity to consider whether it wants to do that and whether there is a lawful way to do that. We already have case law that says the defendant cannot be subjected to a more severe sentence under those circumstances. So we're not talking about sending these cases back and hammering the defendant harder because he took an appeal, merely giving the court the option in the first instance to take another look at this case and determine whether by departure sentences, by changing consecutive and concurrent sentences, or by some other method, the court can get back to or close to the sentence that originally was imposed and that the court believes was the right sentence. I should perhaps mention that there is some case law that may, at least arguably, have the same effect as this bill. In a case called State versus Rodvelt in the Court of Appeals, is that Rodvelt? I'd better not say that. I'm sorry. I don't have that written down, and I don't have the cite to it. I think it's State versus Rodvelt. The Court of Appeals dealt with a slightly different issue, where four convictions came up on appeal, and the court held, well, two of them should have merged into the other two convictions. So there really should have only been two convictions there. And the Court of Appeals did send those remaining two convictions back to the trial judge for resentencing. And that's what we would be asking the Legislative Assembly to approve in this bill, is that process. However, there are a couple of reasons why we still think it's beneficial to have this bill, even though the Court of Appeals has pretty much followed this practice. And there are two reasons, really. One is that was a case involving merger of counts not a case involving finding that the conviction is absolutely void, and so we don't actually have a holding from an appellate court, and we don't have a holding from the Oregon Supreme Court, that in all cases where one count or more is overturned, the remaining valid counts have to go back for resentencing. So it's still something of an open issue. I might also point out that in that case there was a substantial dissent by one of the judges that was on that panel. And so it is still something of an open question, I think, in the mind of the court, whether in all cases to do this. I might point out another, just a drafting issue with this bill. In subsection 2 of the bill, it says, if the appellate court, in a case involving multiple counts, reverses the judgment of conviction on some counts and affirms others, the remaining ones get remanded. And I think it probably better would read on any count, because this would apply if one count is reversed or if two or more counts are reversed. And so with that suggested change, that's what I have for you this morning. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions from the committee?
Mr. Chair?
Mr. Rickson.
Mr. Fessner, am I understanding correctly that the way it works now is the Court of Appeals has the authority to remand for resentencing, but what we're doing here is compelling them to, when this circumstance arises, to remand for resentencing?
Chair Barker and Representative McPherson, that's exactly correct. And part of the reason for enacting this as a statute is that the Court of Appeals has at times treated this issue differently. And they, I mean, this is not a criticism of the court, it's just that they can be sort of all over the map on this issue. And over time, particular panels of the court or particular cases sometimes remand and sometimes don't. There's another case, for example, State versus Fry, that was decided before State versus Rodfeld, in which the court had exactly this issue and simply reversed some of the counts and affirmed the rest and did not remand it. And so this is to bring consistency to what is now maybe not as consistent a practice by the court.
Mm-hmm. Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Please.
Mr. Fessner, you mentioned in your earlier comments, if I followed it right, that this would apply only in those situations where there was an ultimate disposition of the reversed count, that is, where there was not a prospect of retrial. Now, I don't see that in the text of the bill. Is there something about the context? I haven't looked up the statute, but is there something that causes it to apply only where there's a reversal that does not permit retrial?
Chair Barker and Representative McPherson, I think that you're correct. There is nothing in the draft that says that. I think that it probably isn't necessary to put something in to specify that, because if there is a reversal of a conviction and a remand, the whole case is going to go back anyway, because the case is going to be remanded to the trial court for a new trial, at least on some counts. And I believe that at the time that the defendant, if he gets reconvicted, is resentenced, the court would resentence on all the remanded counts. There's a statute in, it's 138.222 sub 5 that already says when there's a sentencing error in any one count or an error that requires resentencing in any one count, all the counts have to be sent back for resentencing. And so if there's going to be resentencing on one count, all of them have to go back under the current statute. The problem is that statute doesn't apply where the Court of Appeals flatly reverses outright, because then there is no resentencing, and then there's no requirement under 138.222 sub 5 to send the whole thing back. This is, I think you could look at this as simply a slight extension of the general rule in 138.222 sub 5 to make sure that it applies not only to remanded counts, but to ones where one of the convictions is set aside outright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any further questions? Representative Thatcher.
Thank you. You were stating a change you might suggest in the second paragraph where it says and affirms on any count instead of on any, or says instead of saying affirms other counts. Would it be fair to say at the end of that sentence to say that the court shall remand the case to the trial court for resentencing on any affirmed count rather than counts? I could just see somebody saying, I'm sorry, we only have one count. We can't send it back correctly.
Chair Barker and Representative Thatcher, I think actually what I was referring to was earlier on in that sentence. Sentence in subsection 2 reads, if the appellate court, in a case involving multiple counts, reverses the judgment of conviction, and it's then this on some counts language. And this actually came up in a conversation I just had this morning with Mr. Nass, and he pointed out, and I think correctly, that you could read, if the court reverses the judgment of conviction on some counts, plural, but then this statute would only kick in when two counts are reversed. And so I think the way to change that would be to just have it read, reverses the judgment of conviction on any count and affirms other counts. Because I think the rest of the sentence is clear enough.
Oh. I guess I was talking about the end of the sentence where it also refers to affirmed counts, plural. So I was just saying to remain consistent, would it be fair or would it be stretching it too far just to say on any affirmed count there as well?
I think that's a good point. It probably should be, because the intent would be, even if you only have one count, it still should go back for resentencing, or if you have more, just as if there's only one count that gets reversed or more. That's I would agree with you. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, thank you. Yes, sir. Ms. Skye.
Good morning, Chair Barker, members of the committee. I'm Kelly Skye, legislative representative for the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, and we do oppose this bill specifically in the form that it is now. There are two reasons why we oppose this bill, and one is just the underlying logic of what Mr. Fussner has proposed here, and that is taking the example that he gave you. You have a three-count case. Presumably, the first count that the person got the 60-month sentence on is what we would call the primary offense, that being the biggest, most serious offense that's charged in this charging instrument, and that's why it got the 60-month sentence. Then there are two other offenses, which were lesser offenses, that each got 30-month sentences. So if the Court of Appeals says they reverse the conviction on that primary offense because, say, as Mr. Fussner suggested, that there was insufficient evidence to convict that person on that sentence, that conviction goes away, that sentence should go away, because when that court sentenced that person, they were sentencing them on that conviction. If that conviction goes away, why should we then send it back to sentence them more on the lesser offenses? That person has just been essentially found not guilty by the Court of Appeals. The Court of Appeals has said, no, there was not evidence to convict this person of this offense. So why should we send this back to the trial court to revive a 60-month sentence that applied to an offense that has gone away? It's flawed logic. The court, when they sentenced that person to 30 months on the other two counts, gave the sentence that they thought applied to those two counts. I was trying to come up with some examples of offenses, and the one that I'm thinking of is, say, a burglary in the second degree, which would be an unlawful entry into a building. So we'll say it's a warehouse of some sort of retailer. And so a person, and generally a burglary has with it a companion crime, because when you unlawfully enter, you have to have the intent to commit a crime there, and most often it's theft. So the person enters the, you know, makes an unlawful entry into the warehouse, and they steal something. Obviously, the burglary is the primary offense. It carries a much higher penalty than the theft would. So on that, on those convictions, and granted, you can never get 60 months on a burglary in the second degree, but we'll go with those numbers just to stay consistent. But say in this instance, the person, it was a novel legal theory on which the state proceeded on the burglary, and the person, and we get a lot of these in burglaries, whether they actually entered, did, you know, maybe they stuck their hand in, maybe they took something that was adjoining on the side of the building, or they took something that was in the doorway, then there's some question as to whether there was really an entry. But the jury convicts the person on this, and then it goes up to the Court of Appeals, and the Court of Appeals says, no, there's not sufficient evidence to convict this person on this burglary in the second degree. Why then should we send it back to the trial court to enhance the sentence on the theft when the Court of Appeals has said they're not guilty on the burglary? So I think that's the flawed logic that creates a problem within with the idea here. When the AG's office says that the Court of Appeals does different things in different cases, that's because they should. There are cases where reversal of a conviction may result in the need for resentencing on the other counts, and where I would think that that would apply is a situation similar to the one that I've described. And this is where it gets a little complex. I know that Ms. Millard will understand what I'm talking about, but when the primary offense is sentenced to a prison sentence and the lesser offenses are going to be also sentenced to a prison sentence, and the court wants that to be a consecutive sentence, under the sentencing guidelines, the grid that you have, in order to sentence that person on the lesser offenses to prison consecutively, the court is required to do what's called a shift to I, which is, so when they get to sentencing the second offense, they have to shift to a different criminal history column, and it's a crazy rule, but it's part of the whole sentencing guidelines scheme. Now, that will affect the sentence on that second count. And if the first count then goes away, you've got the sentence on that second count was reliant and then is actually less than it would have been had there not been the first count. So that is a situation where I can see that perhaps it should go back to the trial court for resentencing on all counts. But what I'm saying is that it shouldn't go back in all cases as this statute requires. Another example of why this statute is too broad is that over the years, the laws of joinder have become very permissive, and now a prosecutor can charge as many different incidents in the same charging instrument as they can suggest to the court are similar in nature. So, for instance, sticking with our example, the offender goes to many different warehouses, and say they do it on different weeks. Every Monday for 10 weeks in a row, they go to different warehouses and pull the same type of scheme, okay? The prosecutor can charge all 10 of those incidents in the same charging instrument. One trial, it's allowed under the guise of judicial efficiency because many of the same witnesses would be coming forth. So there's one trial on all 10 incidents. So if the Court of Appeals reverses the conviction on, say, just that first burglary that we're talking about, this statute allows all 10 of those incidents to go back in front of the trial court for resentencing, and that's clearly inappropriate because had they been tried separately, had the prosecutor not put them in the same charging instrument, they would not all have been able to go back to the trial court for resentencing. So I think that there may be some room to tighten the language significantly on this. I do think that the state has a point in some cases where there may need to be resentencing, but requiring it in all cases, specifically where the Court of Appeals has said, no, this person shouldn't be convicted, which necessarily says shouldn't be sentenced on this conviction, would be far too broad, and, you know, I have been told by people who are litigating this that it is in the courts, that there is a concern of whether double jeopardy comes into play and due process. So I would be willing to talk with the Assistant AG about whether we can tighten the language. One of the ideas that I thought of was to add in, at the very least, the language that counts arising out of the same criminal episode can go back for resentencing in front of the court, so that in the situation where you had the 10 crimes that happened on 10 different days, you don't have all of them going back to the trial court for resentencing. You just have the crimes coming out of the same criminal episode going back. And to further limit it by saying that where the sentence on the remaining counts was adjusted under the rules of the sentencing guidelines according to the crime of conviction that was reversed, that those sentences should be sent back for resentencing. Hopefully that's clearer than mud.
I hear from people, you know, they talk about, well, we need, the judges need to have more judicial discretion. This seems like if it went back, they would have that. And if they didn't feel that, I mean, if they felt the first case shouldn't have been there, that they could then, you know, go ahead and sentence appropriately. But if they wanted somebody to do 60 months for the whole combination of crimes and just the way they originally sentenced and didn't show that, they could still go back to that. Is that...
I understand what you're saying, Chair Barker. I think that the problem here, judges often hang up on the word shall, and maybe there we could put in a may instead, so that if the Court of Appeals thinks, you know, this is a case that shouldn't be sent back for resentencing, that it's not. But when it is a case where they think, oh, perhaps the sentence on the lower offenses was influenced by the sentence on the greater offense, that they can remand it. I think that the current state of the law is that it's not clear whether they can or whether they can't. But I think that when you put in the word shall, you're not giving any discretion to the Court of Appeals and what their intention is in overturning a conviction.
Thank you. Further questions?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Pearson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think all the examples we've heard have been instances where it was a single criminal episode, and so it would seem as though that narrowing would meet the objective that the Department of Justice had in bringing this forward. But it does seem as though to change it from shall to may would essentially render the bill of no meaning, because already, if I understand it right, the Court of Appeals has the authority to remand for resentencing, and what's being sought in here is that under these some circumstances the case would have to go back down to the trial court. Am I lining that up correctly?
Chair Barker, Representative McPherson, I see what you're saying, and you know, not being one who practices appellate law, I can't speak, as Mr. Fessner can, to exactly how often the Court of Appeals remands for resentencing. And again, like I said, my concern is that we not direct the Court of Appeals to remand for resentencing cases where a person where the court should not be resentencing someone, and that's the first example I gave you where the primary offense goes away. We shouldn't be sending them back to get the same sentence on the other counts when the Court of Appeals has said you're not guilty of this offense. And so that is why I would like to have the may in there.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah. Other questions?
I think what I'm going to do with this one is ask you to get together with Mr. Fessner. We have the other little language you'd like to clean up and see if you can agree on it. And even if you can't, we'll put together what we can and we'll bring it back then. So.
Thank you.
Close the public hearing on 2224. Next bill is House Bill 2226. Mr. Fessner, again, please.
Get that little number to the motion.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again for the record, my name is Jonathan Fussner, Assistant Attorney General, Oregon Department of Justice. House Bill 2226 is a bill that would modify Oregon's speedy trial statute. We have constitutional speedy trial rights for criminal defendants, and we have ORS 135.747, which is the speedy trial statute. There's a big distinction between the statute and the speedy trial constitutional rights. The distinction is our statute does not require the defendant to show that the delay in getting him to trial had any adverse effect on him whatsoever, prejudiced him in any way. And as a consequence, this statute is repeatedly used to dismiss cases where both sides are ready, willing, and able to try the case, and the only reason for the delay has been events that are essentially outside the control of the prosecutor and often of the court. Illustrations of that, I'm sure, will come as no surprise to members of this committee. We have had funding problems with the court system for some years now that have resulted in fairly drastic limitations on the ability of trial judges to get cases to trial quickly. We simply don't have the number of judges, the number of courtrooms, the number of prosecutors, and especially the number of appointed defense counsel available all the time to be able to bring all the cases that should be brought to trial quickly to trial quickly. The question is, what do we do about that? And the answer that House Bill 2226 provides is we should require, before a case is dismissed, that the defendant should have to show that the delay has prejudiced him in some significant way. The reason for that is that the people of the state and crime victims have a very legitimate right to have criminal charges brought to trial and have the accused criminal be held accountable for his actions in a court of law. And what we are seeing now, and believe me, there are literally dozens of these cases in which in recent years the Court of Appeals has said, sorry, you didn't have enough judges in June, and so the case got set over, and it was second or third in the priority docket in September, and an aggravated murder case had to take priority, so it was set over, and now it's been 15 months since the time of the crime. That's an unreasonable period of time, and under the statute, that case is simply dismissed. The victim never gets his or her day in court. The interest of the public in seeing crimes successfully prosecuted and criminals brought to justice is simply defeated by the fact that our statute makes it so easy for courts to dismiss these kinds of cases. I think this is also an efficiency issue and a cost issue. And the reason I say that is we have a lot of these speedy trial cases that come through the appellate courts. Frankly, we lose most of them, the state loses most of them, in the Court of Appeals or the Supreme Court, because we really don't have any answer when the court says, well, it's fine, the defendant had no prejudice to him from this delay, but the delay was, let's say, 15 months. And I use that 15 months simply because that was the length of delay in one State versus Harmon, one of the more notorious cases in which the Court of Appeals went through their constitutional analysis and said, well, the defendant wasn't significantly prejudiced here. The delay wasn't really the state's fault. We're not going to dismiss these charges. This was after he'd gone to trial and been convicted. We're not going to dismiss these for violation of his constitutional speedy trial rights. But then we have to turn to the statute. And under the statute, there is no requirement for a showing of prejudice. The delay was an unreasonable period of time. It was 15 months. Case dismissed, conviction reversed, no possibility of retrying the defendant. It takes a lot of time and effort for both sides, appointed counsel and the prosecutor at the trial level, to try these cases and then they come up on appeal. It takes a lot of time and effort for the state and the public defender's office to brief and argue these cases. It takes a lot of time for the appellate courts to decide them, and often it results in, frankly, what I would consider a miscarriage of justice. Let me make one brief point about a term in the draft of House Bill 2226. It uses the language that the defendant is in subsection section 1, subparagraph 2, as the requirement that the defendant demonstrates that the defendant has been substantially prejudiced by the delay. That substantial prejudice language, as opposed to simply prejudice, was intended to capture the concept that the prejudice that would justify dismissing a case for speedy trial reasons should be more than merely trivial. It should be substantial. It should be real. It should be something the defendant can point to and say, it genuinely is not fair, it is not right to bring me to trial after this level of delay. I should say, though, that the constitutional speedy trial cases generally don't use the term substantial prejudice. They simply treat prejudice as one of the prongs of the three-part analysis that the courts use. And so it may, I guess on the surface, it may look as though we're trying to raise the bar here higher than it should be raised. But that's really not the intention. It's simply to avoid a judge saying, or an appellate court saying, well, yeah, the defendant was prejudiced because his case wasn't brought to trial within 8 months, and he had the anxiety of worrying about this driving while suspended charge hanging over his head. Well, yes, that is prejudice in a sense, but it's not substantial prejudice. What the cases generally talk about in the constitutional arena for prejudice are pretrial incarceration. If this person has been sitting in jail waiting his day in court, I think all of us on the prosecution side, as well as everyone, would agree that's a case that has to be brought to trial fast. And if the defendant is being held in jail and he's saying, where's my trial? I'm sitting here, I'm rotten in jail waiting for my trial, and it's now been an unreasonable length of time, I think we would all agree that's substantial prejudice. Pretrial anxiety and worry and sort of community, the people looking down their noses at the defendant because he has a trial or a charge pending, yes, that is also prejudice, but I would suggest it would be a rare case, possibly a very notorious kind of crime, sex crime maybe. It would be a rare case in which anxiety alone would be substantial prejudice. And finally, probably the most common type of prejudice that the courts talk about is where the defendant's defense has been impaired. Because of the passage of time, witnesses or evidence are no longer available to the defendant that would have been if he'd been brought to trial quicker. And again, it's one thing to say, you know, there were, and I'm taking this actually out of one of the appellate cases, there were multiple eyewitnesses to the same event. They all saw it. They all saw it the same way. The defendant comes in, let's say, a little over a year later and moves to dismiss the case on speedy trial grounds, and his claim of prejudice is one of those witnesses isn't available anymore. And that witness might have testified in my favor. I can't, you know, really represent that he will. And in fact, he told the police he saw it just the same way the other eight witnesses did. But he might. And so I've been prejudiced. That's not substantial prejudice, I would suggest. And if you have a real witness who genuinely was going to testify for the defendant and dies or something, that may prejudice the defense. But it should be substantial, not merely a trivial amount of prejudice. I'd be happy to address any questions.
Sure. Mr. Fester, you referred earlier to sort of the efficiencies of administration of justice, and describing situations where there might be a particular activity that would delay the ability to get at a prosecution. And if we were faced with a situation that was sort of peaks and valleys, one can understand the need to try to smooth out the workload of our prosecutors. It's my impression that we have not enough resources to prosecute all the crime that is committed, and we're making decisions then about what to proceed on and what not to. And in that situation, I guess I'd question whether those resources are best spent on an old case, one that's gotten a little stale, as opposed to some new event where all the interest and focus is fresh. And in terms of deterring crime, it seems to me a prompt prosecution is the best deterrent to crime. And reactions to that?
Chair Barker and Representative McPherson, I think I agree largely with that sentiment. There is a problem with being able to prosecute all the crimes promptly and expeditiously, and we probably will never have a perfect system in which every case can be brought to trial within a matter of a couple of months and adequately defended and prosecuted and dealt with. I think the question, though, is when you have a prosecutor's office and a court system trying their best under the limited resources that they have to bring cases to trial, and occasionally, despite those best efforts, a case gets a little bit old. The question is, how easy should it be for that case to be dismissed over the objections of the prosecutor, over the objections of the victim of the case, and in a situation where there's been no harm to the defendant from the delay, and the parties are now in court, they're ready to try this case, the jury is sitting ready to be brought up and impaneled, and the case can be tried. And it just seems to me that this statute errs on the side of just shoving those cases out of the system too quickly and doesn't allow for the occasional problem case that may get set over a few times, but that really should be tried and should be brought before a jury just as much as the more serious ones. This bill by no means makes it impossible or even very difficult to dismiss cases if there has been an unreasonable delay that the defendant didn't bring about himself and where there's been some harm to the ability of the defendant to defend the case or some other substantial kind of prejudice. The courts can and undoubtedly will dismiss those cases. It's just a question of the degree to which it should be easy to do that. And I might just conclude by saying that I think that prosecutors and judges, all the participants in the criminal justice system are very well aware of the concerns that you've mentioned and do try to get the more serious cases to trial more quickly and try not to let cases languish in the system. Part of the problem is you may have a new case that is, you know, 7 counts of identity theft and a burglary, which is pretty serious, and you have a rape case that's over a year old. How do you weigh those two as against, you know, which one should go to trial first when you have one judge in one courtroom? You can't try them both. And I think prosecutors generally try to prioritize their cases and do a pretty good job of it. Unfortunately, sometimes under the current law, cases that we should be bringing to trial, we can't bring to trial, or they get reversed on appeal. Thank you.
Representative Krieger.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Fusner, can you talk to us a little bit about delays that might be or often are sought by the defendant and his counsel? Maybe the lawyer's calendar, his time, multiple motions over time that in some cases I have seen are obviously a delaying tactic.
Chair Barker and Representative Krieger, I'm not exactly certain how to respond to that. I think we all know that there are a lot of things that defendants do in criminal cases that create delay, and those consist largely of pretrial motions, but they also consist of many other things. One of the chronic problems that we have in our court system is defendants who have an appointed attorney, and then they come into court on the morning of trial and say, my attorney and I are not getting along, I want a new attorney, my attorney sold me out. Okay, fine. We have some pretty tough case law that says the trial judge in that situation has to inquire into the defendant's complaints and often has to appoint a new attorney. So the case gets reset. Comes on for trial again, same thing happens. We have some of these defendants who just completely abuse the system that way. And so a lot of things can cause delay. I might point out that the draft bill does not change the language. It moves it from, if you look at the draft, originally there were no subsections in Section 1. Now it's been broken down into two subsections, but it maintains the same substantive language that we're talking about a trial that has not been postponed upon the application of the defendant or by the consent of the defendant. And so under the current law, and it would remain the same under this bill, if a defendant himself causes the delay, particularly by moving for a postponement, or in some other fashion, I've described only a few of the very many ways this can come up, or if the state seeks a postponement, or the court says, we don't have a judge available for this case, and the defendant says, that's fine with me, we don't object to setting it over, then his case would not be subject to dismissal on speedy trial grounds. We're only talking about cases in which the defendant is objecting to any set over, or in which the defendant is not agreeing to a trial set over.
Further questions? Okay. Thank you. Mr. Ms. Skye.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, again, Kelly Skye with the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, and we do oppose this bill. I think it's important to make some further distinctions between statutory speedy trial and constitutional speedy trial that we've been talking about. The biggest distinction that I want to make is that constitutional speedy trial, that's a provision in the Oregon Constitution, you'll also find it in the federal constitution, and that is a defendant's right to be brought to trial within a reasonable amount of time. ORS 135-747, the statutory speedy trial provision we're talking about, is not a defendant's right. It is a housekeeping mechanism that was placed into the statutes. It's intended to serve the court's interests in judicial efficiency. It's directed at cases that languish in the criminal justice system. The courts have been very clear when they discuss it in the case law. And that's why there is no requirement of a showing of prejudice on behalf of the defendant, because it doesn't really have anything to do with the defendant. It has to do with getting cases out of the criminal justice system. And so there are a couple of sort of safeguards that companion along with that statute. And one is that the statute requires only dismissal without prejudice. And what that means is that the charges can be refiled at any time by the state, so long as it's still within the statute of limitations. And most of you are probably familiar with any crime has a statute of limitations, a period during which it can be filed. And for misdemeanors, it's 2 years. For most felonies, it's 3 years, although for murder and sex offenses and things, there are extended statute of limitations. So under the statute, if the court says, you've let this case languish for too long, and they may be saying you to the prosecutor, they may be saying you to the judiciary, because it's just as frequently the judiciary that's setting these things over for lack of resources as it is the prosecutor. But it gets to a point where it's an unreasonable period of time. They say, we're going to dismiss the case. The state, if that case is important, if it's a serious offense, they can refile that case if it's within the statute of limitations. There's a companion statute that says that violations in Class B and C misdemeanors cannot be refiled. And that is just merely to limit the number of those minor cases. The idea being if it hasn't come to trial within a reasonable amount of time and it's that low level of offense, then it wasn't that important to begin with, and we have more serious, more important things to dedicate our resources to. So the important thing to remember is this is a house cleaning mechanism. It is only directed at the lower level offenses to be a permanent dismissal. The constitutional grounds and that requires a showing of prejudice and looks at the reasons for the delay, that is a dismissal with prejudice, which means the state cannot refile those charges. And that is a lot of what Mr. Fussner is talking about, those cases. And in those cases, the courts apply a long constitutional analysis looking at the length of the delay, the reason for the delay, whether there was pretrial incarceration, and what the actual prejudice to the defendant was in all the different areas that Mr. Fussner discussed. This statutory right is an entirely different thing, and it's not directed at the defendant. It's directed at the system as a whole. It basically is the primary motivation that keeps cases working through our system, because without this, cases languish, and they used to. In the 80s and early 90s, cases would languish in the system for years and years, and in 1990, the Oregon Judicial Conference, recognizing this being a problem, adopted a set of standards by which they try to resolve cases. And all non-felony cases are supposed to be resolved within 90 days. Most felony cases are supposed to be resolved within 180 days. All cases, ideally, are supposed to be resolved within a year. This statutory speedy trial, one of the 15 months was the example that Mr. Fussner gave, and that is at the low end of the time periods that the court looks at. Many of these offenses, and in fact, the Supreme Court case on which does most of the discussion about this housekeeping mechanism and the need for it, is State versus Emory, and that was a game violation that was in the system for 2.5 years. And the Supreme Court there said, no, the defendant doesn't have to show a prejudice. This is a case that has languished in the system. The reason that we have this statute is to force people to prioritize, to put our resources where they need to go, and to flush these old cases out of the system. And that is what this statute is for. If you add into it a requirement of substantial prejudice, which, as Mr. Fussner pointed out, is more than the amount of prejudice that's required to be shown under the constitutional statute, you may as well just get rid of the statute, because you're basically doing away with this house cleaning mechanism. You're raising the amount of prejudice that needs to be shown to a level that's higher than required under the Constitution, so the statute becomes meaningless. So it's not a matter of a case getting just a little bit too old. It's a matter of a case getting very old, and the only time that this is going to be a problem for the state is if the case has gotten so old that it's beyond the statute of limitations in the first place. And as I said earlier, most serious offenses have long statute of limitations. The reality is, and where Mr. Fussner and I agree, is that in this time of budget crisis, which I don't think that anybody sees that getting any better, we have to prioritize, and we have to be able to put our resources into the cases that are important, and not allow the system become clogged up with 2-, 3-, 4-year-old misdemeanor cases and violations that are just sort of hanging out there and being set over and set over. We recognize that we don't have the resources to process all these cases. The answer is not to then further delay those cases, to take out our housekeeping and just say, well, we'll just continue to set them over. That's going to cost you more money. That's going to keep all these cases in the system longer, and it's ultimately not efficient. It's going to cost more money. The answer is to keep this housekeeping mechanism in there. It's a good way to force everyone in the system to prioritize and put their resources into the cases that are important, and those are the cases with victims and person crimes, and that's where the resources are going. This will never stop a prosecutor from refiling a very serious case, and it will keep the prosecutors and the courts prioritizing cases in the way that they need to. So we would oppose any amendment to this statute.
I hear from people talking about, you know, the courts don't do anything, or a case got dismissed like in a hit and run, for example. And so they feel really cheated that the whole system's let them down. So, I mean, kind of what about the victim's rights issue?
Well,
I don't, Chair Barker, I don't want to appear callous to victims' rights, but I think that the thing to keep in mind here is that the people of the state of Oregon have again and again said no to different funding measures, and we have to live within our means is what we keep hearing over and over again. And if that means that we can't prosecute these lower level offenses in a timely fashion and they have to be flushed out of the system so that we can dedicate our resources to the serious offenses, then they're getting what they're paying for. And if we want to put more resources into the judicial system and into the prosecution function, who gets their cuts at the county level, and into indigent defense so that we can keep up with all of these, then that's what they will do. If that's what their priority is, that's what they will do. But people are not going to see that that's a necessity until they see that cases cannot be handled. And, you know, in some ways, I think people saw that when the Chief Justice, during the last biennium, just had the set out the order that we weren't going to prosecute these lower level non-person offenses. But decisions have to be made, and that's where they're being made, and this is a mechanism to do that so that they don't have to be done on a case-by-case basis every day by the judiciary and by the state. This is the primary motivation for prioritization in our criminal justice system. And perhaps if people are unhappy with the amount of matrix releases from the jails and dismissals of criminal cases, and frequently they're more angry because the case has taken 2 years to get to trial in the first place, then perhaps we will finally get the funding that we need in the criminal justice system to be able to make sure that we can cover all these offenses.
Okay, just from some of the people I hear from, I did a questionnaire, and they feel like we're not prioritizing correctly, that some of this stuff's going on at the bottom. But any other questions from the committee? Would anybody like to entertain a motion on this?
We'll move.
Thank you, Ms. Sky. We'll move from public hearing to work session.
Mr. Chair. I'm not going to move this to the committee because I'm not convinced that this should be done. I think that the way my perspective on this is that when one has a flow of work, one has to deal with it, what that flow is, and piling up more stuff that you're going to get to someday isn't the way to deal with that most effectively. And although I don't practice in the criminal area, I have seen enough civil enforcement activity to know that people who are have responsibility to engage in civil enforcement will hang on to a case that they've invested some time in because they're emotionally connected to it, but will not, you know, if there's some problem with a case, it's not as solid or as attractive as another case they have to work on, it'll get set over. But until it finally runs through, you know, whatever the legal deadline is for action, they'll hang on to it because they've invested a certain amount of energy into it. So I would not favor imposing a prejudice requirement. I think that this is a question of the administration of justice, and we've got to keep cases moving through the process, and a prompt prosecution is what accomplishes that.
Mr. Chair, I agree too. I mean, to a point, I want to make that clear. I mean, I agree too that we have to make the whole process move quickly. But at the same time, too, I have watched over the last several years where a case has been dismissed that absolutely should not have been dismissed. And actually, I'm in favor of the bill myself.
Do you want to move the bill? make a motion to move the bill?
Yeah, I would actually make a motion to move that bill to the full committee. Full committee.
Let the bill pass, okay. Any further comments? Call the roll.
Representative McPherson?
No.
Representative Olson?
Yes.
Representative Thatcher?
Yes.
Chair Barker?
Aye. The bill will go to the full committee, and Representative Olson will carry that bill.
Good.
Thank you. The next bill we have is House Bill 2227. Ms. Moore, do you want to give us a quick rundown?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2227 would authorize the introduction of victim impact evidence in non-death penalty aggravated murder sentencing proceedings. Currently, when there is a death penalty, or when aggravated murder is the conviction, there are three potential sentencing outcomes: the death penalty, life without the possibility of release, or life, it's called life with 30, that you do 30 years and then you have the possibility of release. When a district attorney's office declares they will not seek the death penalty, or when the offender is under 18 years of age, there is still a sentencing proceeding to determine life with parole or life with 30. And there has been some ambiguity in the law regarding whether or not victim impact evidence is admissible in those situations. This bill would clarify or would add that, in fact, victim impact evidence can come in non-death penalty aggravated murder sentencing proceedings.
Hey, thank you. Mr. Fessner.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, good morning again. My name is Jonathan Fessner, Oregon Department of Justice. I think House Bill 2227 should be pretty non-controversial because it may simply restate what the current rule in fact is. But let me explain briefly why we still think it would be beneficial to enact this amendment. We have a statute, ORS 163.150, subsection 1A. That governs death penalty phases in aggravated murder cases where the death penalty is being sought. And it says that, and these are tried to juries, by the way, it says that in the penalty phase of a death-involved aggravated murder case, what we call victim impact evidence is admissible, and it explicitly says that. Victim impact evidence is the testimony of the surviving, basically family members of the murder victim, talking about the personal characteristics of the deceased, or the impact that the murder has had on the victim's family. And it's a significant type of evidence in these cases. However, if there is no death penalty on the table, and that can happen one of two ways. It can be a person who is under 18 at the time they committed the murder, in which case they're not eligible for the death penalty under Oregon law, or it can be a case where the prosecutor has announced to the court that the state is not going to seek the death penalty in an aggravated murder case. And we have quite a number of those. The number of aggravated murder convictions compared to the ones that receive a death penalty is quite a bit more of the former and not very many of the death penalties. Those are governed by a different subsection of the same statute, 163.150 sub 3A, not sub 1. And that subsection does not mention victim impact evidence. It just is silent on whether victim impact evidence would be admissible in the non-death penalty phase. And in the penalty phase, as Ms. Mowat pointed out, what the jury is determining is, should the defendant get true life without the possibility of parole or life with the possibility of parole? It's a pretty important decision. Now, the only change that House Bill 2227 would make would be to simply add the victim impact language from subsection 1 dealing with death penalty phases into subsection 3 dealing with the non-death penalty aggravated murder penalty phases to make it clear that this evidence is also admissible in a non-death penalty phase. The reason I say that this may be simply enacting what is already the law is not because the way the statutes work, but because of a case called State versus George. That was a non-death penalty aggravated murder appeal in which the state introduced victim impact evidence The defendant was convicted, sentenced to true life. He appealed. And one of his claims on appeal was victim impact evidence should not have been admitted. And at least part of his argument was because the statute doesn't allow it, doesn't provide for it. And I should tell you that the Oregon Court of Appeals agreed with the state's argument that it's okay to introduce victim impact evidence because there's no statute that prohibits it. The statute is simply silent, and consequently, unless there's a constitutional problem with it, which there wasn't, it was proper to admit it, and the Court of Appeals agreed with us on that. However, the defendant sought review in the Oregon Supreme Court. The court granted review. The court reversed the penalty and sent it back for a new penalty phase on a completely unrelated issue having nothing to do with the statute. And then the court said, because this case is going back for a retrial on the penalty issue, we don't have to address whether the victim impact evidence was properly received. And the way I read the appellate tea leaves there, we really don't know what the Oregon Supreme Court would say if squarely faced with this issue and if they had to decide it. What this bill would do is simply make it clear that, yes, as a matter of statutory law, victim impact evidence is admissible in an aggravated murder penalty phase proceeding, whether there is a death penalty involved or not. I'd be happy to answer any questions I can.
Questions? Okay, thank you, Mr. Pressner. Ms. Skye.
Good morning again. Kelly Skye with the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. Chair Barker, members of the committee, Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association opposes this bill primarily because we oppose the death penalty and we opposed the introduction of victim impact evidence as the statute reads now. In talking with members of my organization who practice capital cases, they tell me that the victim impact evidence is a source of a great deal of litigation right now, that they don't agree that it is entirely constitutional in the way that it relates with all of the individual questions that are required to be asked in the penalty phase that the jury must answer. And so because it is such a source of litigation right now, the expanding the use of that evidence, they would oppose and will continue to generate more litigation if it is passed.
Are there any questions? Representative Thatcher.
Yes, just to clarify for me, what kind of litigation would be involved? You know, somebody opposing a victim impact statement, or is this, where is it coming from? Where is the litigation coming from?
Well, Chair Barker, Representative Thatcher, the and admittedly, I don't practice capital murder cases. However, my understanding is that, you know, there are a number of questions that are asked of a jury in the penalty phase. And the final question is there any reason why this person should not be executed? And the question is how, a lot of the litigation is how this victim impact evidence plays into the jury's determination on that final question and whether it's actually relevant, whether the jury should be looking at the defendant and factors dealing with the offendant and whether the defendant and whether that person should be put to death versus the impact that it had on the victim, because the offender generally doesn't commit their offense trying to have a certain impact on the victim, and certainly it's important that the court know what that impact is, but you know, OCDLA's position is that the jury should make a decision whether to sentence that person to death or to true life based on the offender, their characteristics, and the crime that they committed. And while in a later stage it may be appropriate for the judge to hear that victim impact evidence, we're not sure that it's relevant to the question of whether a person should be put to death or put to or given true life versus the ability to be paroled.
But if I understand this correctly, then but this is not talking about, this is in the non-death cases, but capital murder are aggravated murder cases, but they're not facing death.
Correct. And
Chair Barker, that's why I said, you know, the big reason why we're opposing this bill is because we opposed when it was put into the penalty phase, and we opposed the death penalty. So this is an extension of that use of evidence, and so we just oppose an extension of that use of evidence or an expansion of that use of evidence.
Okay. Thank you. Any further questions? Thank you, Ms. Sky. Like to make or move to a work session from public hearing?
I'd like to move that we send House Bill 2227 to full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, call the roll, please.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Representative Olson?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye. And Representative Thatcher, would you carry that? Well, thank you. Is there any further business? The committee will stand adjourned.